Welcome to the Deep End by OnDeck, a podcast where visionary builders, creators, and thinkers discuss world-changing stories and ideas. I'm your host, Marcel Kozloff. Let's dive in.
They would send these kind of messages, like these nasty grams back and forth. Like eBay would do something to stymie PayPal. PayPal build something, eBay would shut it down or like break the widget or whatever. And the detente, the periods of peace, had to be negotiated at a Boston market between their offices because Reid Hoffman and Rob Chestnut could not be seen speaking to the enemy, right, in their respective offices. They had to go to this neutral territory, which is a Boston market.
On Deck is where ambitious people worldwide go to start companies, find their next roles, and invest in their careers. Deep End invites the founders, operators, and investors from the OnDeck community and beyond to turn their experiences into the ideas others need to start their own odysseys. Joining me this week in the Deep End is Jimmy Soni, author of a new book that hit shelves yesterday called The Founders, the story of PayPal and the entrepreneurs who shaped Silicon Valley. Today, PayPal's founders and earliest employees are considered the technology industry's most powerful network. Since leaving PayPal, they have formed, funded, and advised the leading companies of our era, including Tesla, Facebook, YouTube, SpaceX, Yelp, Palantir, and LinkedIn, among many others. As a group, they have driven 21st century innovation and entrepreneurship. Their names are as controversial as they are admired. Yet, for all of their influence, the story of where they first started has gone largely untold. In this episode, we discuss the key differences between a mafia and a diaspora, the psychologically jarring effects of the dot-com bubble, and the competitive work ethic that fuels the alums of PayPal to this day. You can find out more about the founders and some of Jimmy's other books by visiting his website at jimmysoni.com. All right, time for the episode. Let's dive in. Jimmy Soni, welcome to The Deep End.
Thank you for having me, Marshall.
The Founders is out now, so anyone who enjoys this episode, I really suggest they check the book out. Let's start with the most obvious question you could ask when you're interviewing an author, especially with this story. Why now? The people who people think of, Peter Thiel, David Sachs, Elon Musk, Reid Hoffman, they've been big for a while. So it's not as if you couldn't have written a version of this book 6 or 7 years ago. Why is February 2022 the best time to tell this story?
Well, part of that, the honest answer to that question is incidental, which is I don't think I intended for the book to be released February 2022, but there was this thing that happened in the middle with the pandemic. And as a pandemic parent, you know, your schedule kind of gets thrown off a bit. So part of this is just admittedly, honestly, circumstance. Part of it is that today, the day we're recording is the 20th anniversary of the PayPal IPO. And enough time has passed that the folks who are at the core of this story, you know, they don't have as much sort of call it skin in the game with the current company. You know, they've all moved on to other things. And there's also with that comes, I think, a critical distance, an ability to look back at the experience and maybe learn new lessons or refresh old stories. Right. So that's certainly part of it, that actually distance in some ways is a good thing. And then the last piece, you know, not to get too macabre about it, but I did catch this generation as they all sort of pass from the scene, let's say, or pass away. Like, I think it's important to document these stories if you can while the people are still around to tell them. And truthfully, nobody had really gone back and done the exhaustive look at the origin story of PayPal between 1998 and 2002. So in spite of all of that fame, in spite of, you know, wall-to-wall coverage of Tesla, wall-to-wall coverage of Palantir, coverage of Affirm, coverage of everything that Reid Hoffman's involved in, no one had actually gone back and exhumed this PayPal story. And so I felt like now was the right time. And hey, these people are still kicking, so why not?
Yeah, I'm happy you got the second part of the answer because the very obvious it's a COVID book delay thing is a lot less exciting right. than one would hope for. But right. let's talk about this part. The newsiest bit here from a tech zeitgeist perspective is just the idea of mafias. I'm sure you saw the week-long Twitter discourse around, is Y Combinator a mafia? Are people who are funded by YC, or are YC founders, are they conspiring together? This was the Bolt CEO who had a big thread on this. So a lot of people, when they think of mafias in tech, they think of the PayPal mafia. However, I was reading the review, the really positive review the Wall Street Journal put out about the book, and they referenced David Sacks saying, PayPal isn't a mafia. It's more of a diaspora.
Yeah.
So just talk about this idea of mafias. Talk about this idea of people who are related but aren't related. Are they working together? Is there a general culture? Just let's start with the idea of mafias.
Sure. So, you know, if an author can claim to have like a subversive goal with a book, right? One of my subversive goals with this book is hopefully actually to put to rest the whole idea of the mafia. And maybe that's too bold a claim or too bold an ambition, but I'll give you a little bit of background. You know, the PayPal mafia moniker actually is born 1 year after a journalist dubs them the PayPal diaspora. So the PayPal mafia comes from the headline of a Fortune magazine piece that's published in 2007. And on the cover of Fortune magazine, 13 of the alumni are dressed up sort of akin to like the Godfather movies, right? And they're at Tosca Cafe in San Francisco, you know, a couple buttons down on the shirt, gold chains, etc. And it becomes an iconic photo. It's also, I would say, a sort of controversial moniker and photo, and a sort of not particularly representative of the PayPal part of that concatenation. The PayPal part of the PayPal mafia is actually several hundred people between 1998 and 2002. It's not kind of like these 13 people in 2007 in some meaningful respect, right? So that's sort of one thing. But a year before the PayPal mafia label is attached to this group, there's another writer who writes a piece called The PayPal Diaspora. And maybe it's just that it has a couple extra syllables that it didn't quite take root. But in an interview that David Sacks gave, he did like it. He did say that, you know, we're more of a diaspora. And I would actually argue that that's a more accurate framing. And the reason is because it's not as though PayPal's alums go on to do everything with one another. I mean, there are still sort of famously rivalries in this group. There are profound differences in political opinion, different kinds of investments, frankly, different trajectories. You know, I interviewed people who went off and did completely different things, in whether it was in politics, writing, nonprofit, social enterprises, and the world of kind of high-tech entrepreneurship. And so I actually think the diaspora label fits better. This is one other piece of it, because this is actually an important discussion. You know, the mafia, I think, was an attempt to make this whole thing seem much cooler than it actually is, right? Like much more, I interviewed one of the most remarkable people I interviewed was a woman named SB Master. She runs a naming company. She was the one behind the name PayPal. And I actually asked her, I said, what do you think of this mafia thing? You name things, right? She's named things for a living, named Touchstone Pictures, Westin Hotels. She was actually behind the name, the trackpad we all use on our laptops. She's a brilliant, brilliant person. And she said, you know, roughly she told me these are offbeat nerds who aren't particularly cool. I was a little surprised they were able to earn the mafia label. Like, I actually don't think that fits at all. That same comment was made by John Malloy, who was the earliest board member at one of the earliest iterations of the company that became PayPal. And he said, the fact that we think these are the cool kids now, he's like, it couldn't have been further from that when we were all getting started. And so I think it's been played up in the way that the media tends to play certain things up. But I think diaspora is a much better fit, right? Which is they dispersed, they went off and did a ton of different things. And I hope I captured some of that in the book, because I think the mafia label is actually kind of unfortunate. And I will also say it's that picture has some problems. You know, it excludes a whole bunch of people who actually made the company work. And so while it's evocative and interesting and it has some kind of resonance and reach, I think we got to be careful with the mafia label. I would actually sort of like stick with diaspora.
Yeah, and let's actually just start by going over the basics here. Who are just the big players who are involved in PayPal? We spent a little time there just naming name, rank, serial numbers, what they did, what they've done now. But then let's focus on I don't want to say the B players in the sense of not being important, but the people, like you said, when you're doing this story, this book's over, you know, almost 500 pages, there's a lot of deep stuff here. Who are the people and their roles who were undercounted? Because I think if we're thinking of the listenership for this show, a lot of people are frankly going to be in those roles. Those are early people at companies. These are people who are more operator centric. They are could be big investors. Let's just answer the question those two ways.
Sure. And it's actually important to remember that everyone I am about to name who's a household name was basically not one at the period that I'm writing my story. And I should attach a really important disclaimer, I think, for folks who are listening. I came at this book as an outsider. Like I'm not a tech journalist. And yeah, I'm a historian. And my last book was about a mathematician and an electrical engineer. And the one before that was about an ancient Roman senator. So in a way, I had the luxury of actually not really knowing some of the call it the gravitas or the success or all of the things that these people are involved in. But in some ways, that was actually an advantage because I was able to strictly ask them about things that happened between 1998 and 2002. But with that said, you know, some of the bigger names, the recognizable household names would be Elon Musk was a PayPal alum. Peter Thiel was a PayPal alum. Reid Hoffman, David Sachs, Keith Raboy, Max Levchin. The co-founders of YouTube, so Steve Chen, Jawed Karim, and Chad Hurley emerged in this group. Jeremy Stoppelman and Russ Simmons, the co-founders of Yelp. And by the way, I could go on and on and on. I mean, the list is pretty distinguished, but those are your sort of like leading lights and the ones that certainly get, I would say, a disproportionate amount of the coverage.
So this is interesting. Was there something special about PayPal, the company, or was that the area they were focused on, which was online payments, just attracted so much talent?
Oh boy. I'll give the long version of that answer and it will still be insufficient, I think. It was a combination of things. There was a palpably high bar for talent at both of the companies that became PayPal. So the little bit of context that's worth providing is that PayPal is properly understood the unison of two companies. One is Elon Musk's X.com, which he starts in early 1999, and Max Levchin and Peter Thiel's what was called FieldLink, then became Confinity, which was formally launched in late 1998. So there's these two companies. At both companies, I would say there's certain common features. One is a very high bar for intelligence, right? So they're sort of pre-selecting for insanely smart people. They are pre-selecting for a certain quirkiness and weirdness. There's a whole bunch of characters in here, which frankly, like the reason somebody did the book reads like a novel. I was like, yeah, that's because I was blessed with novelistic characters. I mean, you don't find these characters sort of walking the streets every day. And then the third thing I would say is, you know, they faced an enormous amount of pressure within fintech and within this particular moment in fintech for a couple of reasons. One, the companies get created at the tail end of the dot-com boom, but they're really built during the dot-com bust. So you have enormous external pressure in the form of there's no more money, right? Like you've got what you can get, and now we've got to get really scrappy. The second piece is, you know, they effectively play the role of what's known as like a credit card master merchant. They are the intermediary at one point between credit card companies and consumers. And they didn't intend to play that role, but they do because of this email payment technology. It's all at the beginning essentially underwritten by credit card transactions. But you can imagine that if you accidentally waltz into Visa and MasterCard's business and into the business of the banks, and you know you are suddenly under a lot of scrutiny from governments and from Visa and from the banks and everyone else, regulators, the Secret Service, the FTC. So you have pressure that I would sort of liken it to, you know, the kind of crucible that you know makes like a sort of championship team. They went through that in a very compressed period. Basically, I would argue from early 2000 to when the company goes public in early 2002, you have two of the most intense professional years that most of these people ever experienced. In fact, I had a number of them say to me, I've never worked quite that hard ever again. And these are people who have done multiple startups, have said, never worked that hard again. And so you have this crucible experience. It's a long way of answering your question, which is it's not just that there were a certain group of people. They also went through a shared experience that was profoundly intense.
it's interesting, right? At various points in the story, there's all these weird coincidences. So both companies are located in the same building. They're not aware of this fact. And this is speaking to the fact that there was, like you said, this period during the dot-com bubble. Did you ever, during your research, come across other companies that went bust during this bubble where you're like, man, if that had gone a different direction, that could have been an interesting book, or there were these interesting people who all were working there, but it blew up. I'm just curious if you came across anything like that.
Oh, if anything, the disproportionate share of my stories that I was reading to understand that period were about companies that failed, particularly the high-flying example of Pets.com, right? And so we're just coming off of a weekend of Super Bowl ads. So let's like explore that a bit. You know, in early 2000, Pets.com famously takes out the Super Bowl ad that I believe it was called, like, "If You Leave Me Now." And then 9 months later, you know, they have to go into liquidation. And so, in fact, one of the most interesting pieces of this story was the backdrop of the dot-com bust, which was this jarring experience. So you have a period in the mid-1990s to the late 1990s when Silicon Valley can do no wrong, when money is flush and there are, you know, martini parties every night and you could have a napkin of an idea and get funding. And then the way that, you know, David Sachs pointedly put it to me, he said the fall of 2000 in Silicon Valley was like the killing fields, right? Everything died out. Companies that didn't have runway just folded. They suddenly started seeing on the streets like windows boarded up, right? These are once bustling storefronts, and now all of a sudden people are boarding up windows with plywood. And it was psychologically jarring for these people to think, boy, they sort of made it by the skin of their teeth. They're still surviving. The company's still struggling, though. They've got a lot to figure out. But I would say that one of the more evocative anecdotes was a person who told me, he said, you know, there was this website that was a snarky twist on Fast Company at the time. It was called Fucked Company, fuckedcompany.com. And later, actually, the author wrote a book. And I got the book and I downloaded old pages from the site and read them. And he said, you know, we would check that site every couple of days just to see if we were on it, just because we thought, like, we could be next. Like, there's no actual guarantee of success here. Like, we could be the next entry on that unfortunate ledger. And it created a powerful sense of urgency on a team that I think was already predisposed to urgency, right? And so every day felt like, oh my God, we've got to execute. Oh my God, this crisis is coming in. And it was this sort of very intense experience, a very anxiety inducing experience. But that's the context. So to answer your question, the more of the companies I studied failed than succeeded during this period. You have actually a rare success story in PayPal. And I, you know, it's actually one of the things that I think affects the alumni, because they emerge from this period not despondent or down on technology. They emerge from it saying, hey, you know, we survived. It was a lot of work, but we were able to make something and build something and be successful. Let's replicate that same thing again and again.
Yeah, I'd love for you to focus a bit on yourself and talk about your relationship with the dot-com bubble, because as I think back and read these types of books, I realize that bust was basically the first ever interaction I had with venture capital and startups, aside from just the internet, because that's, you know, Microsoft, that's Netscape, AOL. I loved what initially was Home Grocer and became Webvan.
Right.
And I was just like 8 years old, and just one day it just went away.
Yeah.
My parents stopped using it and started using Safeway's delivery service. And I remember the ads were, like, to your point about Super Bowl ads, there was this ad where they called the Home Grocer guy the Peach Man, because there was a peach on the peach on it. So that's always what I've thought of, just one day, this thing, and then it went away. But 20 years later, that's Instacart.
That's Instacart, exactly.
So just as you're thinking of this dot-com era, what differentiates between companies like PayPal that can be early in a space, payments online, and succeed, versus companies that today, Pets.com, that's Chewy, that's what I use personally, aren't really able to make it? What's the real differentiator there?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's a complex question, you know, that sort of has a multi-part answer. And with part of it, I have to freely admit, I am not like an expert in business models per se, meaning I'm probably the wrong person to talk about, you know, what succeeded at the time because of some specific thing that was done right from a unit cost perspective, that kind of thing, right? I'm a historian. I dove into the literature from these years to look at this company. And I did compare it to others and I looked at other models. But I want to give you a qualify. I want to qualify it because I don't want anybody who's listening to like take something I say as gospel and then, you know, make some strategic error because I'm the absolute wrong person to provide that kind of guidance. This is what I will say. You know, there were many players in the payment space at this time. So one of the things I did is I looked at all the other kind of person-to-person payment operators, and I have this kind of like list of the different, you have mobile wallet operators, and you had early cryptocurrencies, and you had, you know, even email payments providers. Elon's ability to sell his vision, he was also very candid with me. When we first spoke about this story, he said, you know, we weren't the only email payments player in the game. Accept.com was right there with us, and they were acquired by Amazon. And his line was, it wasn't that we invented email payments, we just made it better, right? I would add a couple of sort of bullet points to that. One, the team nurtured and goosed user growth really aggressively. So you asked the question, like, why were they successful when others were not? That was one of the questions. One reason is as soon as they figure out that they actually have a home base on eBay, meaning eBay auction buyers and sellers are using X.com's products and Confinity's PayPal product to do transactions, they go whole hog. There's a little bit of reluctance initially. They're like, eBay, really? And then once they say, no, this is called product market fit, they do everything they can to understand that payment process in every way possible. Let me give you an anecdote. I interviewed this amazing member of the product team. His name is Denise Aptekar. And Denise described to me that when they discovered that they were successful on eBay, her then boss, David Sachs, told the entire product team, I want you to go out and buy something on eBay and study every single frame of the process, from the bid to the auction process, payments, the number of emails, every single piece of it. We need to understand this at a microscopic level. And she goes and does that. Now, she says to me, she said, Mitch, she said, you know, I bought this landline phone and it came caked in cigarette smoke. And I was a little bit skeptical. Like, is this really the market where we want to make our killing? But the point was to really have a detailed understanding of the market in which their product had found a fit. So that was one thing, was they just like really obsessively focused on that market and understood it at a very fundamental level. The second thing is, and Meg Whitman, by the way, who was their competitor, admits this freely, they were very aggressive. This team would move faster, move more quickly than their counterparts at other payment systems. I had a person I interviewed who was a customer service rep in Omaha. Omaha was where PayPal's customer service was. And she said, one of the things that most impressed her about Palo Alto home base was that if customer service identified an issue, Palo Alto would have it fixed within 12 to 24 hours. Not always, but often enough that she was impressed by the speed and it left a memory that lasted 20 years. So they were moving very, very, very fast. And they felt like everything depended on those moves, right? So that was sort of thing number three, is this level of aggressiveness. That aggressiveness, by the way, extended to giving out $10 and $20 payment bonuses in order to goose growth, like early customer growth. And so you're talking about putting real money on the line for that aggressiveness. The last piece I would say is there was a fundamental recognition of what markets worked and what markets didn't. So I'll give you an example. There's this amazing catalog I came across that was the 4 years worth of newsletters that the company, internal company newsletters. And David Sachs has a column that he writes for like a period of, I don't know, 6 months. And somebody on the team will ask a question and David will give like an op-ed length answer. So from my perspective as a historian, this was pay dirt, right? Because I'm getting the person who is the head of product answering these questions. There's this moment when someone says, why don't we become the payment servicer for Pizza Hut or for Papa John's or Domino's? And David gives this answer and he says, you know, we have to be very precise about where we try to make our technology work because we've seen it be so difficult on eBay. Meaning if you are going to take over payments for a particular corner of any market, you have to make sure that you're actually a fit. And what he says is, with Domino's and with Pizza Hut, those would be evolutionary, not revolutionary steps for us. And we know how hard it would actually be to get them to even tolerate or accept us. Meanwhile, by contrast, online gambling had a payments problem. There were no good payment providers. They weren't willing to move fast. It was a really risky, legally murky market. There was a lot of noise in that system. But David and others identified, like, no, we can get high margin payments to work for online gambling. And they don't have a good solution set yet. And so they were very strategic about which markets they expanded the business into. And there's this great line that actually another product manager from his team remembered years later. He said, "World domination will not be achieved by parachuting indiscriminately into hostile lands," right? And again, two decades later, this product manager, Premal Shah, actually remembered that line and said, "You know, David wrote this great email once or something around world domination is not going to be achieved by parachuting indiscriminately into hostile lands." And there was a lot of truth to that. They were very selective about the places that they decided to go after that first success of cornering the eBay auction payment market. So those are a few of the reasons that I think they were differentiated from other payments providers. I would add too that part of it was timing. You know, they arrive on the scene and eBay hasn't quite rationalized payments. So let's not ignore that that's a huge part of this too.
Well, this is interesting because the theme that you're describing when it came to gambling and eBay is these are scenarios where low trust monetary stakes. What would the possible need, what would Pizza Hut's need for PayPal be in the first place?
I think now we would answer that question differently now than we might have in 1999 or 2000, right?
Yeah. That's so, right. I'm trying to think of
what were like they in 1999 or 2000, it would have been a novelty. Now it's a necessity. So back then, you could attach payments to anything, right? Like you could theoretically take an offline business and an offline retailer and try to quote unquote digitize them and have PayPal be some kind of intermediary by which someone can cleverly send an email payment to somebody else. But in truth, it's going to be far easier for somebody to just pay with cash, right? Or whip out a credit card and pay on the phone. Like those are technologies that people had access to, meaning the technology of cash and the technology of a credit card. An email payment system would have been a novelty. It also likely for a pizza retailer would have been more trouble than it's worth. Potentially, there have been security issues. These are franchises. Who's actually accepting the email, right? You have fraud risk. I sympathize hugely with the words that David wrote at that time. Like, this is going to be way more trouble than it's worth. He was also skeptical at the time that offline retailers would be a good time and resource investment. So one of the things he does in this column is he talks about how long it takes for PayPal to actually nest within a market and talks about the amount of like shoe leather it takes to really earn trust. And so he's not arguing that it's not a good idea. He's trying to provide a pretty solid analysis for why that, relative to other things, that's not where PayPal should put its chips. And I will say one of the things that David and the product team were very good at, which I think is a lesson for people listening, is you cannot fight all battles at the same time. David, he admits, and others have told me, he earned a reputation within the company. He calls himself Dr. No. He was like, "I was Dr. No." And the reason is because he often had to say, "No, we have like precious engineering bandwidth. We can only do a limited number of things very, very well. So I don't want the you know, potentially media headline generating partnership with Pizza Hut to overshadow the less like, you know, less exciting, but more important work of signing an international partner or of continuing to grow our share on eBay and protecting ourselves there." And so there were trade-offs. There was opportunity cost. He was very rigorous about identifying that opportunity cost and closing off opportunities for PayPal because he understood that just because you have network effects within a limited market doesn't actually mean that you'll like take over everything just by virtue of yourself self-generating growth. You actually have to be really discriminate about, we're going to go here, but not here. We're going to go here, but not here. So another good example is, you know, there was some prospective PayPal use for the sale of marijuana. And a marijuana seller approaches Reid Hoffman actually and says, "Hey, I've got this weed business. Can you set me up to use PayPal for this?" And he goes back to the company lawyers. And, you know, again, like low trust market, like a little bit of murkiness, could be a little bit like gambling, but it's flatly illegal. And Peter has a what he calls a no orange jumpsuits rule, which is like, we're not going to do anything that risks orange jumpsuits. So we're staying away from anything illegal. people. So there were you know, these choices are not easy, but it's one of the things that actually, for a young team that was dealing with a fast growth startup, it was one of the things I found most surprising, is that there was this level of like writing and rigor and real thought around distribution, which markets we're going to conquer, which markets we're not going to conquer.
You know, the way you differentiated between novelty and other use cases instantly made me think of the dilemmas facing anyone in the crypto Web3 space. In terms of, this thing is going to be novel, it's going to be fun. Yes, I could order that pizza with Bitcoin. I guess I could use this Web3 version of social media or Twitter. So whether you're in the space now or thinking about it, it seems that whoever could differentiate between the novelty and the just essential thing would be. So do you have any articulation / initial thoughts on how one could develop a framework for differentiating between the novel and just the actually essential?
You know, I'm going to have to depend on some of the moments where that choice was real for PayPal and for the early creators there, because it's the only experience that I feel any confidence actually drawing on. You know, I a few thoughts. Actually, here's an interesting one. When Kinfinity, Peter and Max's company, first gets its start, they're one of the early iterations of the product, the famous one, is beaming money between Palm Pilots. So what I'm going to do with this amazing product, PayPal, is you and I are going to be at lunch, and you know, famous podcaster that you are, you're going to cover the bill, and I'm going to pay you my share, and we're going to whip out our Palm Pilots, and I'm going to beam you $10 through the infrared ports, and that's how we're going to reconcile the debt I owe you. And it was an amazing novel concept. I mean, a brilliant use of a feature on a Palm Pilot that actually hadn't gotten any use, you know, up to that point. It generates headlines, it generates buzz, it's interesting, and it has a very limited ceiling on its possible users, and it's got real technological glitches. I read Palm Pilot for Dummies as a part of doing research for this book, and there's this great paragraph in the book in Palm Pilot for Dummies where it says, if the Palm Pilots are too close, the infrared beaming won't work, and if they're too far away, it won't work. So you got to sort of get the Goldilocks distance just to make these things operable, right?
And or I reach into my pocket and give you $10.
Exactly, which is a perfectly useful thing. Yeah, exactly. And so you have this, but you have this novelty. Now, what the novelty does is, the novelty attacks press. It actually brings in an applicant, Chad Hurley, who hears about the technology and applies to work at the company. He's later one of the co-founders of YouTube. It does generate buzz and attention, but it has a very limited actual use. Now, what? Fast forward, let's say 5 months later, the place where PayPal is being used is not eBay, is not a place that Max Levchin actually fundamentally wants this emailing money technology to be used. He would like the world to be lit on fire by the idea of Palm Pilot money beaming. But it turns out that actually people are buying Beanie Babies and sending $10 to each other to pay for said Beanie Babies over email. And at first, he is not happy about this. But David Sacks, the board, and many others within the company recognize, like, this is product market fit. We've achieved it. We should actually shift in the direction of this boring but fundamental use case, as opposed to the exciting but limited use case of Palm Pilot technology. And the funny story actually is, even a year after that, what I just described, Max Levchin is still servicing bugs on the Palm Pilot technology, sort of in this, you know, faint hope that this thing is going to take off. And the best line belongs to the person who ran customer service. His name is David Wallace. He said, when we finally shut the Palm Pilot technology down, I thought, this is really, really sad for a really, really small number of people. You have this tension between novelty and product market fit, and call it sort of like actual use. And one of the things that the team did really well was lean in the direction of actual use in spite of their reservations, meaning they actually had to kill their darlings, right? They had to like really sort of burn away the things that weren't going to work. By the way, they had built mobile payment technology for the Cassiopeia, the Sharp Wizard, Windows CE, which was like the Microsoft mobile platform, in addition to the Palm Pilot technology. So this was not a small undertaking. This was the core of the company. They abandoned the core of the company to focus on the emailing money technology, right? And so there's a willingness to shift very, very quickly. And by the way, what I'm describing sounds easy, but I suspect for most people who are listening, this is actually so difficult because you have an emotional stake in the technology you build. You have a personal stake in it. You have time invested. You have sunk cost, right? And so it's more than being able to just look at a PowerPoint in a sort of antiseptic way and say, we're going to go with B, not A. It's actually you've poured your life into these things and you're being asked to abandon those things and shift in another direction. It's not easy. I think one of the things that made this team successful is that they had people in their ear. One of the people, by the way, who's most vocal that the Palm Pilot technology is going to be a dud is Reid Hoffman. And he's super vocal. He's actually the person who raises the objection that leads Max Levchin to create emailing money technology as a companion to the PayPal infrared beaming technology. And so that was a long answer, but I think this tension always exists. I think you have to have a kind of emotional hardiness and almost a stoic approach to the products you build and over-index on the things that users are actually using. I'll add a story I haven't shared. Actually, I didn't share it in the book. And maybe to my discredit, right? Maybe it deserves a place in the paperback. One of the people I interviewed, you know, because you're talking about fundamental digital technology. One of the people I interviewed surprised me. He was a product designer, and we had a great chat, and he told me about a bunch of the different design configurations, little tweaks, things here and there. And he said, oh, I should tell you about the interviews I did. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, oh, I actually like flew around the country and flew around the world, and I interviewed 250 PayPal customers one-on-one. And I said, wait, really? I was like, that sounds like a really analog process for a super fast-moving company with millions of users. And he said, it was the most valuable thing I did. He said, I would sit with users. They would be on their laptops or their computers, and they would show me how they use the product. I could very quickly identify pain points, and then we would go back and just fix them super fast. And so there's a way in which the focus on not just the theoretical end user, but like actually sitting in the living room with someone and putting that level of investment into understanding how people are using the thing you created. I mean, I suppose I'm an outsider to the world of tech, so I didn't know enough to be impressed by it, but I found it impressive nonetheless. Like that's a fundamental kind of product empathy that I think is necessary. And I remember hearing that and just being blown away, because here I'm thinking that these people are sitting in Palo Alto, you know, trading bits over the internet and fixing big financial systems. But in point of fact, like one of the things they did so well was just catering to users and being in users' living rooms gathering information. You know, would that all companies could do something like this.
Yeah. And I want to go back to an earlier theme, because the story of PayPal is really contentious early to mid-range relationship with eBay is very relevant, because if you're looking at modern tech narratives, basically since 2012, 2013, everyone is hyper aware of the danger of building a business on someone else's platform. So this is an issue that publishers run into with Facebook. Obviously, Facebook is running into this with Apple and limitations on privacy, with tracking. When you build your platform and your business depending on one player, you can be entirely screwed. Whole companies, publications, et cetera, have been destroyed by this idea. So the pushback to David Sacks, Dr. No, could have been something like, well, I get that we've got product market fit on eBay, and it seems like focusing on Pizza Hut and all these places are distractions, but your product market fit is another way of just saying we are dependent on this one company, which hypothetically, no, not just hypothetically, we know this, was saying to themselves, why are we letting these randos build an essential part of our platform effectively when we don't own that thing? Mm-hmm. And the last thing I'll say too is that you contrasted what PayPal was doing with Visa. So that's the legacy. Credit card companies, legacy banks. eBay is not a legacy company. eBay is still I wouldn't call it a startup, but it's one of the early success stories from the .com boom. So how does this all play into that? Because I think the history worked out, but there's a world where it didn't work out when it came to becoming dependent on eBay and how they managed to survive that dynamic.
Yeah, it is one of the great dramas at the heart of this story. It was one of my favorite things to research. you know, I was an early eBay user myself. And so it was nice to do the walk down memory lane and think about the stuff that I bought. You know, the founder of Beanie Babies came from Westmont, Illinois, which is where I grew up. So it was nice to even walk down Beanie Baby memory lane.
Did you buy, was the first product you bought a Beanie Baby?
No,
that is the most obvious question.
It was not. I'd sort of aged out, but they were exciting. I wish I had. They'd be worth a lot of money now. But I would say I can't offer a kind of comprehensive case study answer to the question of whether one ought to build atop another platform. What I can say is this, you know, eBay had focused on building the best auction website that it could. It had not rationalized or regularized its payments process. And so the best example, or one of many examples, they purchase a payment startup called BillPoint. They buy them in early 1999, and everyone on these teams, meaning Elon's team and Peter and Max's team, Luke Nosek actually said to me, he was a member of Confinity, he said, phew, we don't have to do payments on eBay, thank God. eBay is slow to integrate BillPoint into the eBay payment flow. They still allow their users to have other options, and so there is an opening. It's a tiny crack of a door of an opening, but there's an opening for PayPal to fix this broken process, to make it easy for people to pay each other. Because until this point, someone said to me, they were like, it was like payments came from like the 1950s on eBay. Like you could pay by money order or check or cash or just mail thing. You know, it was a really cumbersome, complicated process. Not a lot of tracking, no security. You know, so it's a really, there's like a part of this is just missing, which is why PayPal ends up owning the cash registers at someone else's store. However, as you described, this has tons of hazards. It's basically one of the overarching stories here is surviving while eBay is battling them, right? They're a barnacle on the side of eBay's ship, and you have people like actively trying to get them off. And some of the liveliest conversations I had were because I didn't want to tell a one-sided story. If I only interviewed PayPal people, but didn't speak to anybody at eBay, I'd only get one narrative. I interviewed the people who are on the other side of this fight, and actually had to deal with like the nuisance that is PayPal, right? And I interviewed people like Jeff Jordan and Rob Chestnut, who were at eBay at the time. And you know, it's funny, they had two or three observations. One is, he said, look, they were good. Like they built a good system that our users liked. Like, you know, we weren't doing it. Somebody did. And, you know, they get credit there. They said, the second thing is we had to follow user sentiment and our users loved their product. So anytime we tried to make moves, it actually led to customer outcry. So we were sort of handicapping ourselves if we try to like, you know, do something to throw them off their game. And then the last piece that they said, and this is sort of the obvious business reality, you know, payments might have been like a few points for eBay in terms of a total business, right? Meaning if they had owned payments, they would have also had to own all the difficulties that come with payments, fraud, everything else. And at the end of the day, the margin on that might have been relatively low compared to the like profitable auction business where they can offload, where the revenues and the costs align in a more favorable way. So they said, look, you know, they sort of took the riskiest part of the business. They ran with it for a while, made it work, solved the fraud stuff. So we essentially bought a technology we would have had to figure out. I think that's a generous interpretation in some ways. I think PayPal did an incredible job of fighting fraud. It was really, really hard. And so I would sort of go most of the way there, but not all of the way there. But I think that, you know, they were fortunate that eBay hadn't figured it out. But it was very, very, very choppy waters to build within that platform. I'll give you a story. One of the stories I remember is they would send these kind of messages, like these nasty grams back and forth. Like eBay would do something to stymie PayPal. PayPal built something, eBay would shut it down or like break the widget or whatever. And the detente, the periods of peace, had to be negotiated at a Boston market between their offices because Reid Hoffman and Rob Chestnut could not be seen speaking to the enemy, right, in their respective offices. They had to go to this neutral territory, which is a Boston market. And they'd have to negotiate these agreements where they were like, all right, you can't do this, you can't say this, you can't say our pricing is this. And there were commitments and agreements on both sides. I would say that eBay gave PayPal a foothold. This is Catherine Wu described it. She said, eBay was an important foothold for us. The creators of PayPal had always envisioned the possibility that PayPal could grow beyond eBay, that it could be a universal payment system. But it was really hard to do that if you didn't have a core group of users. In my final analysis, I think of it as a remarkable testament to cleverness and aggressiveness that they got this little foothold on eBay and then just fought like crazy to make sure that they could stay there and grow. And then eventually in, you know, July of 2002, eBay announces that it's acquiring PayPal, right? And so in a funny way, it all sort of worked out at the end for both sides, financially for eBay and from a product building perspective for PayPal. But it is the high drama in the whole thing is, oh, geez, like we're the foxes in the hen house. Like we, you know, we own these cash registers, but the cash registers are servicing a different business. From a product development perspective, what it did was it allowed PayPal to grow, and it gave them a seed group of users that were going to do transactions.
What I'm thinking about here is you keep giving these examples that, for good or for ill, just don't exist anymore. So once again, we talked about happening to be, not only is there one company that's working in an office, but there are two companies that are working in an office, and the office is these offices are in the same buildings. Going out to meet at a Boston market because all of these companies are operating in the same specific part of a specific state in the Western United States.
Right.
Obviously, for anyone who's listening to The Deep End, these are no longer defaults when it comes to this space. So I'd love for you just to talk in this bit about the ways that this story is just so different now and what the implications of those differences are for folks who are building their own companies, growing their careers, those different parts.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think that, you know, I suspect my answers might be more obvious than not, but I can take a stab at thinking about them. One is, you know, Confinity and X.com had a hard time recruiting at the time because the talent market for engineers was so tight and, you know, there's a sort of supply and demand problem. And they were in some ways sort of limited and competing against these big companies that had just gone public, like Netscape, like eBay, where you had more safety and more security. I suspect, though can't confirm, that in the choices some engineers are making now, I suspect that a startup and a startup environment is more appealing in some respects. I do these meditations within the book that others offered about how Max Levchin would convince an engineer to choose Confinity over Google, or to choose the startup over the established player. I suspect, both because of the narratives that we tell about startups and some of the money that's flowed into the industry, that that's different now. It's actually easier to win that recruiting game fundamentally in some way. I think you are also recruiting from a talent pool that's stretches around the world now. We're not in a dial-up internet phase anymore. No one has to be in the Confinity office above a bakery on University Avenue in order to get this work done. PayPal has some branches and offshoots outside of Palo Alto. They establish a big and very important customer service center in Omaha. They also have outposts in Ireland and in India and elsewhere during the time that I'm writing about. But I think that now you've got your pick of the litter of people who can self-educate, who can, you know, join a company, keep odd hours or not, and just get their work done. That's a big difference. The third thing is, you know, when I spoke to the people who created this company, they at the time did not have access to literature around agile software development or around these sort of processes about how teams and code are built. A lot of that language came later. PayPal develops a freemium model. The word freemium isn't really like sort of written about at any length until the early 2000s. So they have to sort of make it up as they go along. There are more case studies now, more ways to write code more efficiently, more understanding about how these dynamics work. The industry, I mean, simply because the industry has gotten much, much bigger. There are veterans, there are resources, there are books, there are narratives. So I suspect there's more just fundamental knowledge about this. So you're sort of having to invent less, having to make things up a little. You probably can do a little bit less of that per se. And then at the time of my writing, despite the internet success, joining an internet company is still seen as a as sort of not a mainstream choice, if that makes sense. Meaning that it isn't just sort of that if you're an engineer or if you're a computer science graduate coming out of the University of Illinois in 1997, 98, 99, you do have the trailblazing example of Marc Andreessen, and he's made the cover of Time magazine, so you could go on and do that. But for a lot of other people, you still had sort of plenty of bricks and mortar businesses where you could get a perfectly good job. Today, that's simply not true. Everything is technology, right? Like everything is X and a technology company. So it's a more mainstream career. So you have less, I think, reluctance around things like this. But I would also actually say, Marshall, that there's more in common, I find, with the start or founding of any business, whether it's in 1998 or 2022, than there are differences. Like the challenges that these people were facing, you know, for all their intellect and later success and everything else, the challenges on like how to recruit, how to sell the narrative of the company, how to fundraise, how to achieve product market fit, how do you build a team that makes sense and isn't just sort of like at each other's throats all the time, but still keep the intensity and the pace up. Those are timeless questions, right? Those are sort of big challenges that exist today that I'm sure exist for the listenership that's building businesses, but then also like kind of just are true of building anything, right? And so I would say that there's more in common with this period than not, but I think some of the differences have actually made it easier to do some of the things that they had to do.
So in the last bit here, we kind of got at this, but I just want to ask the question very directly. It's not that there weren't other companies of other impressive folks who either succeeded or didn't succeed during this era. It's just the fact that this company actually just had so much talent here. You know, people who not only founded next big companies, but like David Sachs is a Hollywood producer, and he also creates a huge podcast. Peter Thiel obviously does a bunch of different things there. Reid Hoffman, so on and so on and so forth. As you're saying, starting a company is going to look similar in different eras. How much does this come down to, man, if you could just happen to hire 15 to 20 of the top 100 tech mind operator thinkers, et cetera, during your era, you'll win. Like how much is that it, right? Because we're doing a good job of being structural, and you're actually giving, despite your, you know, lack of Harvard Business Review pedigree, a good framework for people. But it's hard enough just to say, man, if I'm a CEO or a recruiter, I should just work to get the top 0.01% in every single one of these different categories, which this company seems to have done. But that also seems like too reductive of an answer. Just how do you think about that dilemma? Because I'm trying to balance that takeaway from what obviously, because the message is obviously not as simple as, yeah, hire Reid Hoffman and Peter Thiel and David Sachs and then get Elon Musk and then just go for it. That's not the takeaway.
Right. Right. Let me offer some bit of a nuanced answer that'll hopefully be more useful, because it's important to remember that at the time that Peter is hiring Reid Hoffman, he's not Reid Hoffman, right? At the time that he's recruiting David Sachs is leaving McKinsey and Company, and he's not some product czar or wizard, right? At the time that Max
left, he's the consultant that people in tech make fun of.
Exactly.
To get into tech.
At the time that Peter invests in Max Levchin, you know, Max wants to do mobile encryption libraries for a company called FieldLink. He's not looking to build a consumer payment email payments behemoth that, you know, today is valued at $300 billion. Like, he is somebody who's fresh out of UIUC. He's sleeping on a mattress. So I would say that actually your answer is right broadly, which is like hiring the sort of very tippy top in terms of intellect and other things. But I'm not sure that this was a conscious process for them at the time. In fact, I know it wasn't, in part because they struggled to recruit, particularly Confinity. Elon had more success because he was actually, you know, he had succeeded at Zip2, his prior company had sold. He had some brand value. He could be in the press. People would pick up his phone calls. But Confinity had a heck of a hard time recruiting. So it's not as though they had their pick of the litter of like, well, we'll just pluck David and we'll pluck Reid and we'll get Elon and okay, everything's great because we have the Avengers, we have the Olympic team of technologists, right? In fact, quite the opposite. So then the question, it begs the question, so what are you looking for, right? Let me identify some things that aren't going to be, that are non-obvious. One non-obvious thing. Puzzle solvers, people who in their spare time play chess or enjoy card games or like really like obscure logic problems, right? But for the love of the problem solving, there were a whole number of people, known and unknown, who were cut in that mold, right? Meaning that what they did for fun was actually puzzle solving. And there is, I would argue, a direct line between that and fraud fighting really successfully at the company. Meaning that a problem solving ethic, puzzle solving ethic was actually a part of the place. And it was, as one designer said to me, she was like, you know, the engineers just did it for the joy of the solution, right? Sort of like the sparking the joy, like for Marie Kondo, but applied to puzzle solving, right? So there's a kind of like, just focus on that, like a sort of a distinct joy in figuring out the right answer. The second thing I would say is they hired people who had broad intelligence. So for all of the sort of narrow focus on like engineering and code and, you know, do you know how to do X, Y, and Z at a very tactical level? You know, I also had conversations with these people about novels and about films and about kind of offbeat like theories and various things that they were just studying and reading. This was a really broad-minded group of people in the kind of content and media they consumed. And so, you know, like I'll give you an example. One of the first things I talked to Max Levchin about was I had heard that he was really into Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. And he's actually watched Seven Samurai over 100 times, and he calls it his only source of management training, right? You know, Seven Samurai is one of the great 20th century films ever, you know, by any critical measure. And I found this again and again, that each one of these people had some really like an interest that if you're just trying to be successful in tech, like you don't, you know, you wouldn't have this sort of love of this other thing, right? I found that over and over again. So a sort of broad-minded intelligence is probably like a decent indicator. The last thing I would say is, there were a healthy number of people in this story who are very, very, very competitive. And I think it's easy to sort of look at a competitive streak in someone and see it as a deficit, to maybe see it as something that's going to make them too aggressive. But there were a whole bunch of people in this story who liked to win. And I think that you don't want a team of people like that, because I'm sure it just makes everyone crazy. But there is something about a desire not just to get the right answer, but to get the right answer quickly and to be faster than the person in the cubicle next to you that was definitely in the water here. And I would say contributed to their willingness to push back against Visa, their willingness to push back against eBay, their willingness to set artificial enemies and then try to defeat them, right? And let's use a cultural analogy. You see this time and time again in the later stages of Michael Jordan's career, where he doesn't have anything left to prove anymore. He's won championships. He's won every award you could win. So he creates fictitious battles in his mind with these opponents, right? In order to win. But that kind of competitiveness also brings out the best in him and the best in the people around him. And so do I think this is probably a healthy way to live your life? No. But do I think it's something you might look for in someone else where you're like, wow, this person really likes not just doing well, but being the best? And I think those are two different things, right? Like one might be sort of more Buddhist and the other is not. That competitiveness is actually something I found in person after person. And I think of it in the right doses, in the right times and places, it's an asset. And so I would argue that it goes a level deeper than just hire smart people. There are these little cultural hallmarks and little things that come in. I should add one other thing, and I'm sort of admitting my biases here. There are an astonishing number of people at the heart of the story who are immigrants. I think the majority of the co-founders of ConfinityNX.com are immigrants. The highest profile people, the people you and I talk about just now, Elon, Peter, etc., all immigrants. And I'm not saying that's like some kind of requirement. I'm simply, but as an immigrant myself, and as the son of immigrants, and as someone who's sort of like looked at literature on this, you know, certainly there's a part of this that is tied in intimately, and a part of Silicon Valley history that's tied in intimately to the idea of not having a safety net, perhaps, or leaving a place and then having to uproot yourself and create a whole new life in another place, or having facility with languages and having to just learn really fast and sort of get culturally adapted. I'm not the right person to answer the why, but I can tell you the facts, the data on this company is just person after person, you know, arrived here from foreign shores. And so there's something possibly around that. But I do hope people walk away with some sense that there's more to this than just getting lucky and happening to choose Reid Hoffman as your COO early on. Because I do think it goes way beyond that. It is about, because it's not a team of all Reid Hoffmans or all David Sachses or all Max Levchins. It is actually a very heterogeneous team. Some you know, some you don't. And they have little distinguishing features that are worthwhile and I think worth learning from.
Very well said. Jimmy, books out. So I highly suggest that everyone go check it out. And thank you so much for joining us on The Deep End.
Marshall, thank you for having me. This was
in The Deep End. In The Deep End. And you got to stick with the metaphor.
Right. Maybe it works both ways, perhaps. But thank you for having me. This was great.
Thanks for joining us in The Deep End. If you enjoyed your stay, give us a review on Apple Podcasts and share this episode with your friends and colleagues to help grow the show with us. We've also got show notes and more episodes available at ideas.beyonddeck.com. See you next time.